I'm relatively excited about this evening's lesson. Partly because it's an interesting text, one that I don't know that I've ever preached on, actually, and a very interesting topic that I have preached a lot on over the years. But largely because I have been waiting literally 22 weeks to preach this. We have been going through the Bible 20 pages a week on the average, and the first week I was reading Genesis chapter 20, 1 through 24, and as I told the congregation, the plan was, generally speaking, that I was going to probably preach a sermon from the text, not every week maybe, but a lot of weeks anyway, and I wasn't exactly sure how that would work, and I looked at the first 24 chapters of Genesis, and I've got about 24 different sermon ideas, and that is really not much. I could have gotten 24 easily. I don't think I actually counted 24 of them. But this is one of them that I just didn't have time to preach at the time. But I made notes, and I said, one of these days, before too long, I'm going to get back to this. And here we are 5 months later, and we're finally talking about there is no fear of God in this place. This is the very first time in the Bible that the concept of the fear of God occurs. And this is a concept, of course, that permeates the Scriptures, Old and New Testament life. We talk about the fear of God, the fear of the Lord, constantly. And the concept of fear in a more general sense. Lots of times the fear is a negative kind of thing. The fear of man is the most common fear, but also fears of death and et cetera, a whole series of things. But there is one very positive fear, at least it's usually referred to in a positive way, and that is the fear of God. And here Abraham is in his wanderings. That's how he lived in the land of Canaan. He wanders toward the south of what we would call Palestine or Israel, and is camping near Gerar, near King Abimelech, and he maintains good relations with the people that he comes in contact with, almost without exception. And he bumps into Abimelech and has some problems. And he anticipates that there's going to be problems, so he convinces Sarah, his wife, to go along with his ruse. He's going to get her proposed that she is his sister. And my parents like to call a lie, by the way. You don't do that kind of thing. And it's kind of especially odd with Abraham, because not only is he a great man of faith, a man who is known for his connection to God and his determination to do the things of God, but this is actually the second time he's done exactly the same thing. And when he went down to Egypt, the same kind of thing happened, and he told the same lie back then and didn't get away with it again. It seems really odd, in fact, that Abraham would try this not once, but even twice. And his excuse is that he thought, going into this foreign land, that he would encounter bad people doing bad things, and that he himself would be killed. And as he sums up in verse number 11, I thought to myself, there is no fear of God in this place. What I would like to do for a few minutes here this evening is make a few basic, minor points about this, and then the lesson will be yours. So I'd like to begin by making a general observation here, which I think is a terribly important one, especially in the modern day, and that is that the fear of God dramatically and directly impacts the morality of the culture. This is essentially the point that Abraham is making here. There is no fear of God. That would result in Abraham being killed for his wife. Why would he think that? Because the fear of God has a necessary and almost inevitable positive impact on the morality of the society that is fearing God. Now, maybe we ought to back up a little bit and talk about the fear of God, exactly what this is. And this is, I think, in my 12-part sermon that I preach in this is three of the parts. So we're not going to burden you with a couple hours worth of sermon here. But in a nutshell, the fear of God is a reverence, an awe, a respect, an appreciation for God's power, for God's authority, for God's holiness, for God's identity, His personhood, acknowledging that He is up here and that we are down here, and generally directly associated with the idea of the fear of God is a commitment to moral excellence and obedience. If you fear God, then you're going to keep His commandments. That's what Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13 tells us. Solomon, the wisest man in the world, tells us that's what it is. You fear God, you keep His commandments. Those two things go together almost every single time. And when you don't have the commandments being kept, it's a pretty good indication that God is not being feared in that particular situation. What we have here in Gerar is that
what Abraham, anyway, perceives as being a godless world is no doubt being impacted for ill because of this lack of fear. And you can see how this works, right? If you do not fear God, if you do not have any reverence for God, if you don't have any acknowledgement that God exists or that God judges or that God has power over the world or over eternity, then you are going to be emboldened in your sin. One of the main, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons why we do not commit sins is because we fear God. Because we acknowledge God punishes sin. I don't want to be punished, and so therefore I'm going to try to avoid sin. Now, thankfully, we live under grace where we can be forgiven of sin, but that's a whole other topic here. The fear of God compels us to holiness and righteousness. And by extension, the lack of the fear of God, what you see oftentimes in the Bible, what you see in our culture oftentimes today, you see a wholesale retreat from God, from the things of God, and sometimes that takes the form of paganism or atheism or whatever it happens to be. A rejection of the things of God tends very, very generally, and there really aren't a whole lot of exceptions to this, in fact. The more you retreat away from the God of heaven, the more you find yourself immersed in sin. And even the religions of the world that claim to be bastions of holiness, some are better examples of this than others. Some people, even in their pursuit of righteousness, in their pursuit of their vision of godly, righteous behavior, will engage in sin. I want you to see this as a natural and to a certain degree inevitable result of a lack of fear of God. When you embrace a rejection of God, there is almost necessarily attached to that an embracing of the things that are against God. That's why you see these satanic rituals you hear about on the news or on the internet or whatever. You see various pagan rituals. I don't know if any of you have seen Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. You know, it gets pretty gross sometimes. I don't know exactly how literal all this kind of thing is, but I do know that there are religions in the world that practice even today that engage in extraordinary barbarism, up to and including the loss of life. This is what happens when we do not fear God. The contrast to that is a God-centered culture, a culture that embraces God, that embraces the things of God. It is only natural that that culture pursues holiness. And there are extremes of this as well, of course. Many of you know the story about the early pilgrims that came to this nation and felt, in a very literal sense, I think they were somewhat deluded in this, but nevertheless, they thought that they were doing God's work by establishing this beachhead in this new land. That they're going to build the perfect society. And they felt, in their heart of hearts, they genuinely felt that if sin came into the company, God would punish that entire company. And that's why they were so harsh with people who were slackers or who blasphemed or in some other way rejected the things of God. Because if they allowed sin into the midst, it defeated the whole purpose of this experiment. And it would quite likely bring the wrath of God down on everybody. They were determined then to keep their population pure, to keep it clean. Now again, I think they went to extremes that I would not encourage in this country or in other countries. But nevertheless, the general idea of using the things of God as a pattern for your culture, a pattern for your society, is an extraordinarily good idea. What we see instead, and what we oftentimes see, and I know that we talk about Romans chapter 1 and cultural decay a lot, but I think that it's tough to get away from this. If you watch the news very much, if you're on the internet, if you go to Walmart as far as that goes, it's difficult to escape this. The world that we're living in a very real sense, has gone to the devil. And we see this having ripple effects on our culture as a whole. Paul writes in Romans chapter 1, in the midst, by the way, of a culture that's ever been as depraved as ours, if not more, he says that this is specifically because that culture did not fear God. Skipping down a little bit to chapter 1 and verse number 28, just as they, that is the Gentiles at large, just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, they didn't fear God, they didn't acknowledge God, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil. That's my favorite right there. Inventors of evil. Disobedient to parents. That's my second favorite. For obvious reasons, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful, and although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice things such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. What he's saying here is that this culture, deliberately or not, and the indication is some of it was deliberate. They knew the things of God, they rejected the things of God. And as a result, God gave them over to this lifestyle that they had chosen for themselves. And it just got worse and worse and worse. Don't read into that that God didn't care about them, that God somehow or another wanted them to sin, wanted them to be destroyed. That's not the case. God's not willing that any should perish. We understand that, I hope. But rather that if you choose rebellion, if you choose depravity over the things of God, God will let you do that. He's not going to drag you to heaven kicking and screaming. If you're determined to be depraved, if you're determined to reject God, either as an individual or as a society, God will allow that to happen. And I think when it says here, God gave them over, it's not saying God pushed them down the mountain, as it were. But rather, God created the mountain, and he created the opportunity, and they fell down the mountain themselves. That happens in our culture just as much as it ever did in the Roman culture. Individual indulgence is going to be encouraged. We see this over and over again. The more sin, the better, essentially. And that you're not likely to hear that kind of terminology, although sometimes you will. You're encouraged to live life to the fullest or to get the most out of it. You only go around once. Or there's all kinds of different cliches that are used these days. But what it basically boils down to is you need to get as much sin in as you possibly can while you're here. That is, again, the opposite of what God wants for us. And as a necessary attachment to that, you can't have the one without the other. There's no such thing as accountability. The idea that there's a God out there who's watching these things, who's going to hold you accountable for the things that you've done, the choices, the bad choices you made. Well, we can't have that, because then people won't sin as much. And I might even be forced to feel bad about my sin. Well, we're not going to have that. And so before too long, you have an entire culture that is built around this idea of rejecting the fear of God. And it inevitably leads to the kind of cultural and moral decay that is becoming, I fear, more and more the rule rather than the exception in our society. I would like to think we can turn this thing around. I'm not holding my breath. I think that we're going to have to do the best we can in a world that is increasingly devilish and likely is going to continue to be increasingly devilish. And that bodes very poorly for our society, because we can look at the Assyrians, we can look at the Babylonians, we can look at the Persians, the Romans, the Greeks, on and on we can go. Of these cultures that eventually, especially at their apex, were considered to be grotesquely immoral, that they wallowed in their sin, they wallowed in their depravity. God brought them down. God destroyed them. And generally speaking, it wasn't so much a matter of some greater power came in from the outside. They ate away at themselves from within. Moral decay will destroy a culture. It'll destroy our culture. Everybody in a good mood now? Everybody excited? The good news, of course, is it doesn't have to be this way. You can choose morality. You can choose the fear of God. And whether or not it catches on, whether or not you have an impact on your society, you can be right with God. And your family can be right with God. And this church can be right with God, because we've chosen to live in the fear of God instead of living in Satan's world. Now, let me offer you a caution here. And this is the maybe the reason more than anything else that drew me to this text. You need to look to your own fear instead of the world's fear. We can get so caught up in the fear of God that does not exist, and that we fully expect to not exist out there in the world, that we turn a blind eye to our own situation, our own problems. This is the great irony here. That Abraham, of all people, is going to stand here and say, I behaved in this way because I thought that other people we're not going to be living in the fear of God. And because of other people's presumed failures, he himself failed morally. He himself did not live up to God's expectations. Now, I realize in this context, it is Abimelech who is held accountable for these things. It's he who is chastened. It's he who is warned and threatened by God. But I don't think that any of us would argue that that means Abraham was perfectly okay in what he did. Abraham put Abimelech and other people as well, including his own wife, in a compromised position because he himself did not live in the fear of God. It's he whose fear of God is really in doubt in this entire episode. And it's, again, ironic that this is Abraham that we're talking about, the great man of faith, the one who in large measure defines the idea of the fear of God. In numerous passages, including fairly recently in the narrative in Genesis chapter 17 and verse 16, there are other passages as well that clearly indicate, and this is not too far removed from this event, by the way, that God had a specific plan for Abraham. That Abraham and Sarah, his wife, were going to have a son. And this son would be the seed through whom all these great promises were going to be ultimately fulfilled. The land promise, the seed promise, the nation promise. This was going to come through their son. Not through Hagar's son that she had with Abraham in their, you know, weird little ad hoc relationship. No, it's Sarah. Sarah's going to have a son. Well, she didn't have a son yet. Well, does that mean God lied? Has God forgotten about it? Or has Abraham forgotten about it? Now, as often as Abraham has been reminded of this over the last 25 years or so, now maybe three or four visions from God wouldn't be enough for you. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't enough for Abraham. But he's been told this is going to happen. And here he is in a potentially life-altering situation, and instead of trusting that God's going to take care of him, instead he just assumes, well, I'm in this on my own. I'm going to have to figure something out on my own. And as we touched on before in Genesis chapter 12, verses 10 and following, Abraham is in this, there, then he was known as Abram, of course. The same situation comes up. And the same condemnation takes place. Abraham was wrong at this point. He was wrong before. Now, what we like to think, now we all make our mistakes, right? We're not rationalizing, we're not justifying, but we do it. We make our mistakes, and hopefully, they aren't too bad. Hopefully, we can catch ourselves before it gets too far advanced. And most importantly, we're able to learn from them. Because I mean, what's the point in making mistakes if you're not going to learn from your mistakes, right? Well, Abraham didn't learn from his mistakes. He's in a compromised situation. He fears for his life. And so, he puts Sarah at risk. Just tell him that you're my sister. He was wrong then. Why didn't he learn and not subject Sarah and himself to the same situation the second time around? He compromises his integrity here. He makes himself to be less godly than he would have been otherwise. Look at chapter 20 and verse number 9. This is the man of God that we're talking about here. Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." Now this is a pagan, presumably anyway. We don't know exactly what Abimelech's faith was. He appears to have acknowledged the God of heaven when God spoke to him, so that's something. And he knows enough at least to know that Abraham has made his situation worse instead of better. Now, how would you feel if you had an opportunity to have an influence for good in the life of one of your neighbors, and because of your influence, because of your association with that person was further away from God than they had been before? That'd be kind of a disaster, wouldn't it? That's the opposite of what walking by faith is all about. That's what Abraham does. He brings disaster and doom, not a blessing from God, but a curse from God. Because he, for whatever reason, refuses to live in the fear of God in this particular moment. I have no problem praying for our leaders, praying for our nation, praying for those ones who are in power, praying for people in foreign countries, etc., etc. Big issue praying. I'm all in favor of that. If you're in the habit of doing such things, do not grow weary in well-doing. But let me emphasize something to you. There are things that you control and there are things that you can't control. And if by praying to God you're acknowledging that he's in control of these big issues, that's great. Go ahead and do that. But realize something. You actually have control over a certain part of that world. And perhaps your time and energy would be just as well, if not better, spent focusing on your own issues, your own shortcomings, your own spiritual needs, than the needs of others, imaginary, hypothetical people out there in the world. We don't criticize Abraham for wishing that the world feared God more. That's a good thing. The world ought to fear God more. We do criticize Abraham for not being introspective enough to look at himself and realize that he himself was not where he ought to be in terms of faith. Now, that's a difficult thing for us because we like to think of ourselves as people of faith. This is a Sunday night crowd. You've gone the extra mile, as it were, literally, to come back here this evening. Many or most of you were here this morning as well. And that's a good thing. That's a wonderful thing. Thank you very much for doing that. You're demonstrating by your presence and by your repeated presence that you're trying to walk with God. And a lot of people aren't doing that. And there is a tendency to think that somehow because we are participating in the things of God, or even participating to what the world would consider, even our neighbors, our religious neighbors would consider to be extreme extents, it's natural for us to think, if we're not careful, that somehow we're immune to this. That we're definitely in the fear of God, and we don't have to worry about that whatsoever. If we were to be truly introspective, if we were to look at ourselves, if we were to look at our brethren, many of whom are not here, have gone to the world, we would realize, we would acknowledge that we are not necessarily as secure in the fear of God as we might think. We are not bulletproof. We can fall, and if we're not careful, we will fall. We need to be extra cautious for ourselves. Yes, this is a wicked world that we're living in, absolutely. But that is not an excuse for us. We have to remain diligent. I'll refer you to the words of Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 3, in verse number 13. And I realize, for the most part, Paul is here talking about evil influences in the church. But the same basic principle applies with regard to any influences at all. You're going to run into some bad people out there. People who are going to stab you in the back. People who are going to tell lies about you, hurt you, all that kind of thing. We're sorry about that. We wish it weren't the case. It is the case. Paul says, but evil men and imposters will proceed from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. Bad people doing bad things. You, however, continue in the things you've learned and become convinced of, knowing from whom you have learned them, and that from childhood you have known the sacred writings which are able to give you the wisdom which leads to salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. Now, Timothy learned his teachings from Paul. Well, so did we, didn't we? We read what Paul wrote. We read the things that he wrote to Timothy and wrote to the various churches and individuals that he had known that are preserved for us by the Holy Spirit through the text. Remember who's teaching you. Not just Paul, not just John and Peter and Matthew, Mark, Luke, and all the rest of them. But that Jesus Christ himself is teaching us. Remember that Jesus is pulling up to this higher level, this higher spiritual dimension, trying to get us to live different kind of lives than we were living before. And like we were talking about this morning, you can either participate in that or not participate in that. That's your choice. But if you want to embrace the fear of God, then don't use a world that is not living in the fear of God as an excuse for our own shortcomings. We can do better. We need to do better. Now, thirdly, and we'll close with this, a warning. And that is this, that your failures of faith impact others. And Abraham is a rather grotesque example of this in this particular situation. Abraham, obviously one of our great heroes of faith. We talk about the positive aspects of Abraham's life far more often than negative, but there are negatives. And this is one of them. There are times when people of faith will let God down, they will let one another down, they'll let themselves down. And when that's me, when I'm the one who falls short, and I fall short as much as the next guy, there is oftentimes, especially if it's done in secret, there's oftentimes this tendency to think, well, that's just my problem. It's just between me and God, and I'll make that right with God, and that'll be the end of it. The Bible talks occasionally about secret sins. And sometimes we convince ourselves that our failures are only our failures. And I want to assure you that that is not the case. When we compromise our morality, when we compromise our walk with Christ, when we are not what we ought to be spiritually, there are other victims, not just ourselves, others as well. And sometimes it's relatively obvious, such as the case with Abraham here. What would have happened if God had not intervened here? What if this course that Abraham chose for himself, what if it had been allowed to progress? It's pretty obvious what would have happened here. God directly intervened here, providentially and supernaturally, to keep this from going to the next step. But we all know what the next step was. Without getting just overly grotesque about it for the sake of the tender ears in the audience. Bad things are going to happen to Sarah in this particular situation. Abimelech himself was going to die, and his group, his family was going to die. God told him that specifically. Sarah was going to be shamed and embarrassed and humbled in the most humiliating of ways. That's not the way God wants us to live. God requires us to be lights in the world rather than part of the darkness. We have an obligation to stand apart from the wicked world. If the world is in fact wicked, if the world is in fact not living in the fear of God, it is that much more important for us to embrace the fear of God, to be a stark contrast between the things of the world and the things of God. Again, in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse number 8, there are people who care about us, who look up to us, who need us. And you can argue, and I think argue pretty well, that 1 Timothy 5 verse 8 is talking primarily, if not exclusively, about providing in a financial way, providing in a physical, carnal kind of way. But surely if there's any way of providing for your children that's important, it's a spiritual way. And if Paul, by inspiration, pronounces this curse upon people who won't pay their bills and keep a roof over their children's head, how much more so is a curse pronounced against one who encouraged their children to go to hell? If anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. We have an opportunity and an obligation to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And that is especially the case with regard to people who are close to us, who are near to us, who are connected to us by family and other social connections. I think probably, if I had properly appreciated what it meant to be a father when I was 24 years old, I would not be a father. It's an awesome responsibility, a humbling responsibility. I'm not discouraging you from becoming parents, young people out there. But I am saying that when you accept that role, when you accept that responsibility, you are accepting custody of little souls that are put in your charge and left in your charge for the rest of your life. That is mind-boggling. It kind of scares me to death just thinking about it. And my children, by and large, turned out pretty good. My job isn't done, though. Tracy's job isn't done. And if you're a parent, your job isn't done either. We need to continue to be that positive, good, moral example for their sake. And also, obviously, for the sake of those who are living in darkness, for those ones who have not accepted Jesus Christ, those ones who have rejected the fear of God, and may continue to reject the fear of God. This may be a lifestyle choice that they've been embraced for the next 50 years. Or maybe not. Perhaps, it's happened before, we know of examples, where because of the positive impact, because of the evident holiness and godliness of the character of an individual Christian or a group of Christians, someone who is mired in Satan's world looks to that and sees an alternative for the lifestyle that he's chosen and says, yes, I want that. I want to be able to rejoice in all things. I want to be able to have the peace of God that surpasses all understanding. I want to be like that person. And if Jesus got them there, then I want Jesus. At least I'll try it out. Philippians chapter 2, and many other passages. I'll just refer to this one, though. In Philippians chapter 2, and verse number 14 and following. And far be it from me to pass on an opportunity to talk about attitudes. When we are pursuing holiness, when we are living as lights in the world, it is so very important that we do it with a positive attitude. He says here, do all things without grumbling or disputing. Now, sometimes we'll quit there. And I think we can get a good point out of that. But notice the context. So that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. I understand what Paul's saying here. You have, as a Christian, you have an obligation not only to stand apart from the evil of the world, not only to embrace the fear of God in your own life, not only to be seen doing so by the people in your vicinity, but also to be seen rejoicing in so doing. Do not grumble or dispute. Let me tell you something. You can be crabby and not know Jesus Christ. Lots of people who don't know Jesus Christ are crabby. That's easy. Can we do better than that? Do you think that maybe your neighbors would be more drawn to a happy, joyful Christian than a crabby Christian? No offense to the crabby people over here. Sorry about that. Doesn't it make sense that we would have an obligation to them to not only show what light looks like, but show how wonderful it is to live in the light? How grateful we are for the opportunity to live in the light. This is what the fear of God has done for me. It may sound terrifying, it may sound scary or negative, but it's not. It's wonderful. It's the best choice I've ever made. You ought to do this too. And in so doing, make this stark contrast, as black and white as we possibly can. Your life does not have to be this way. You can and you should do better than that. I'm doing better than that, or trying. And I want you to come along with me. That is a message that will resonate with people in our culture, in our society, in our families, in our neighborhoods, that are fed up with the absolute disaster that Satan has wrought in their life. Not everybody is fed up with Satan, but some are. And when we can come along and provide a contrast, say, when you live in the fear of God, you can have a better life. Somebody might be interested in that. Surely it is at least worthwhile for us to give people the opportunity to see a difference between what life in the world looks like and what life lived in the fear of God looks like. Abraham's example was not perfect by any means. He lived, his family lived, and he stands today as an example of faithful and righteous conduct. And our example is not going to be perfect either. I'm sure yours hasn't been perfect, mine hasn't been perfect. But what we can do is rejoice that God has given us this day and given us this opportunity to draw near to Him, to confess our faults, confess our need for Him, to try to do better in the future, to renew, rejuvenate the fear of God in our own heart so that we can be a better example in the future, better example for our neighbors, better example for our spiritual family. Draw a little bit closer to God every single day. And one day, wind up, of course, in heaven with all the saved of all the ages. That's what happens for those who live their lives in the fear of God. We're going to give you an opportunity here this evening to capitalize on this fear, to make it work for you. It's not enough just to have fear. You need to be moved by that fear. Most initially, to be moved to the water of baptism, because Jesus said, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. If you haven't done that yet, you need to do that. That's what Jesus told you to do. If we fear God, we're going to keep his commandments, including that one. If there's any other way we can help you walk with Christ, help you draw closer to him, more exemplify the kind of conduct that God would have you exemplify in this life, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing.